Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 15th of June. We welcome you to the program and thank you very much for being with us. Hopefully you had a beautiful weekend, one way or the other, that you enjoyed your time. And we come back together to talk about what's going on in our world with a distinguished panel. Let me introduce them. And real quick, before I do that, I'll introduce, welcome you to join in on the discussion. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will go to our letters a little bit later on, but we welcome them now. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning. How are you, Alan?
Good morning, Big Joe.
How you feeling? All right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good to have you. Thank you very much. We also welcome the UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, back to the program. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning to everyone.
Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program. Also, Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at American University Cairo, Jim Ketterer is here. Hello, Jim.
Hello. It's good to be back, and good to hear the roundtable music, as always. They do such a great job.
Yeah, we're listening to John Batiste and Corey Wong this morning from an album called Meditation. So good stuff. We always have a playlist posted online, WAMC.org/roundtable. Thank you for the opportunity to give that plug, Jim Ketterer. Now we go to political consultant Libby Post. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We're fine. Good to hear your voice. Welcome.
Nice. Thank you.
All right. Let's start with today's story, and we'll make it our top story, which is Atlanta's top prosecutor says his office will decide this week whether to bring charges against the police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks, a black man whose killing outside of Wendy's on Friday sparked a fresh wave of protests against police violence in the southern city and added fuel to nationwide anger over racial injustice. Family members on Sunday recalled Brooks as a good father who was getting his life back together when he was shot and killed in a confrontation with Garrett Rolfe and another Atlanta police officer after a DUI stop. Public outrage mounted across the country over the weekend as demonstrators in New York, Los Angeles, and other cities and towns took to the streets for the latest in a wave of protest prompted by last month's killing of another black man, George Floyd, in the custody of Minneapolis police. I am interested in, let us begin, I should mention Rayshard Brooks, 27 years old, and the video is quite alarming. Jennifer Burns, what do you make of this particular situation?
I'm not surprised. I think, there's been many discussions in the last few weeks that this kind of police brutality or excessive force was going to continue to happen. And I'm deeply saddened by it. And I sadly believe that he will not be the last case of this across the country.
When you look at this situation, I mean, I guess, of course, it comes at a time when, we're still embroiled in this debate and people are still on the streets. So this reignites any fires that we're starting to abate somewhat, but all of the issues are still the issues, right?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, we're going back and forth still, state level and federal level about how to do some police reform, or to defund or to, and so nothing's really changed. We have awareness that has changed. We have more video footage. We have a lot more people watching, but when it comes down to the law itself, nothing has changed really yet.
Should charges be filed against the officer?
Absolutely.
And why?
And I want to point out, I've been digging, really trying to look into this a lot more, and it appears that in Atlanta they at least had for a while, and I'm not sure if it's disbanded prior to this, but this particular officer was also on the force for quite a few years, and they had a special operations unit, the high intensity traffic team, that was supposed to handle DUIs or driving while impaired situations. And so when we've been talking in all of these discussions the last few weeks about training, right, and vetting officers and procedures, if this officer was part of that unit. And this is what can happen. It highlights even more how training and programs need to change. Because he's supposed to be a specialist in how to de-escalate and handle these situations. Right. And this is what happened.
Alan, what do you make of the situation?
Well, you know, I was watching all the clips pretty carefully. You know, it would appear that what happened in the beginning was they were following some protocols. They were calling him sir. They were doing what they needed to do. And then this awful thing happened where they shot the guy in the back. One wonders, of course, if somebody were white, whether they would have been shot in the back. It comes down to that. It's pretty simple. I was fascinated by the fact that there's a lot we don't know, that the police chief quit. Why?
Erica Shields resigned on Saturday. Right. And again, she quits. And yet you would think, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in this, but you would think both the charges against the officer and the resignation of the chief would come relatively at the same time.
Well, yes. And one wonders why she quit. Now, you can project a lot into this. You can suggest, well, maybe what was happening was that there was the word was out from the chief and the mayor and everybody on down. We're not shooting people. We're not going to shoot anybody. And when somebody got shot, it called for her quitting. And either, you know, when people quit, quote quit, it's usually because somebody has said, now it's time for you to quit. And I think that may be what happened here.
Just to clarify, according to the article in the Washington Post, there was a sobriety test given to Brooks. When he failed the test, officers attempted to put him in custody. The response escalated and Brooks grabbed an officer's stun gun and began running away.
Right.
Video of the encounter appears to show Brooks turning back toward the officer and pointing the taser at him, at which point the officer is seen drawing a weapon from his holster and firing at Brooks. Libby Post.
You know, this is just another example of white police officers taking the law into their own hands. They didn't have to shoot this guy in the back. You know, he was running away. Yes, he had a taser. A taser's not going to kill a cop, you know, unless the cop has a heart condition. And if the cop has a heart condition, he shouldn't be on patrol. He shouldn't be doing this kind of work. You know, it's after everything that happened in Atlanta after George Floyd, I'm not surprised that the police chief stepped down, whether she was told to or not, because one would have thought after everything that went on that there would have been some conversation perhaps with the rank and file in the police department saying, de-escalate. And yet here we have a situation. I watched the video too. You know, it was, hey, bro, what are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. You know, yeah, he was intoxicated. That's not a reason to shoot somebody in the back. There's been a number of these kinds of shootings where people are running away. Yeah, he turned with the taser. Look, you know, shoot him in the leg. Shoot him, do something that makes him, you know, not be able to function, but don't shoot him in the back. Don't kill the man. You know, it just doesn't make sense. I'm not an advocate for shooting him in the leg either, but, you know, if they have the option of getting what they consider to be a deadly weapon out of his hands, they should do what they can before shooting somebody in a way that we all know is going to be lethal. There's just no two ways about it. You shoot somebody in the back, you're going to either hit their heart, hit internal organs, sever their spinal cord. I mean, let's be real.
The officer,
and the person's going to die.
The officer who shot Brooks twice in the back has been fired. A second officer nearby has been placed on administrative duty. And as we mentioned, the police chief resigned. Jim Ketter.
Not to just repeat what everybody else has said so well, but also to mention something that you mentioned, Joe, in the lead-in on this story, and that this week the prosecutor is going to be deciding what to do. And I think the role of prosecutors and their ability and their willingness to enforce the law in these police situations is one of the areas that I think is a key element of change. And if there is going to be change, the prosecutor's offices across the country have to be able to and have to be willing to do that. So I think this is going to be a key test in this case. And then it's something we ought to be watching in all the cases that sadly will continue to come. Will DAs be willing to step up and enforce the law against police forces that they work with every day?
When we look at this, at the situation, and again, and we broaden things out, Jennifer, of where this brings us in the overall protests and the movement and change that we're seeing in cities, changes that we're seeing in Capitol Hill, or at least proposed changes, where does this leave us, do you think?
I think it goes back, you know, to Jim's point here about, you know, prosecutors enforcing the law, but also actually seeing the laws and the repeals that are taking place, like, say, in New York, actually being fully implemented, because it's going to take a while for departments across the state to actually redesign, however they're going to do it, their local policing, and then following the laws and then having prosecutors who can actually enforce them when it comes down to it is going to be critical. And we all know, and it has been shown in a ton of research and reports, that juries are often unwilling to convict cops.
Right.
So we have to add that point in there when it comes to where are we going to go from here with this. You know, and I think also, you know, the other thing is this video footage. It also appears that this is such striking excessive force because they already have the man's name. They already have his car. They, you know, there's so many other ways that they could have tried to find him, you know, or, and you have to think about too, in this case, here are these officers now whipping out guns and shooting them. There's people filming this. Who else in this crowd here could be hit by these bullets? So I think these are all the things that we have to consider when looking at how the laws change, and then also if prosecutors can enforce any of these new laws, and juries and the people will see that their safety, even if they're not involved in the actual incident, is also very important to take into consideration.
This is something that bothers me. It's an impossible question to answer, I realize, because we'll never know. But I'd wonder if this case would be on our radar and be on the radar across this country if we hadn't gone what we've gone through over this past several weeks.
I would say I doubt it. And
yeah.
I would say that, too, because what has been lost starting the conversation is how officers a few weeks ago tased those two college students in Atlanta.
Right.
Right, when they pulled them over, and I know it was during the protest, but they did that. And those officers were charged, some of them terminated. You know, there's still, that case is still kind of pending. So we would not have known about that either. So you can kind of tack on just in that one place some of these local transitions and incidences. We would not have had that without the footage.
And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is what's going to happen when this all gets to a jury. We know it's very hard to convict policemen. You know, there's somebody sitting there and say, well, you know, he thought somebody was raising a weapon at him, and I'm not going to vote for it. We'll have to see whether that changes now, because that's always been the history of all of this, whether that changes.
Well, and then they have to charge him first, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jim?
I think that it's important to take that step to actually bring charges. That has been an impediment all along. The jury thing, I agree, is a big problem. But if in fact what we're seeing is a real change in the country, or at least enough of a change, I'm cautiously hopeful that we'll see that also translate into how juries see these things. Cautiously, but remain hopeful.
The New York Times has a story this morning also about the growing re-examination of the use of deadly force by the police. This is something that Libby touched on in her remarks, challenging long-standing principles that have given law enforcement officers wide latitude in cases in which an encounter ends with death. Although laws vary by state, police officers in America are generally allowed to use deadly force when they are reasonably, when they reasonably believe their wives or the wives of others are in danger, a legal standard designed to give the authorities enormous leeway to make split-second life or death decisions without hesitation or fear of prosecution. Jennifer, how do you look at that and think to make it fairer for, well, for everyone, but certainly for white officers arresting African Americans?
You know, I think we need to find a way to do better with language, right? Because reasonably believes it can be different to different people. And if people are struggling, as we know, with internalized racism, you know, or stereotypes about groups of color, then they might perceive often the actions of African Americans who are being stopped or other minorities who are being stopped as threatening before there's even an engagement with the police, right? And so in many minds, that's already reasonably, like they already believe that there's a reasonable scare or danger or, you know, something going on there. And so I think we have to work on some of the language here we use for reasonably believes or, what kind of threat or possible injury, those kinds of things. Because if the person stopped, again, is a person that others already have ideas about their criminality, preconceived notions of their criminality, they're going to think that these cops are always in danger. And that's going to taint the whole process.
We are going to pause there. I'm just going to pause there and we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have much more to talk about on this issue and other issues as well. Of course, we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post, all making up the panel this morning. And again, we welcome your thoughts. All you have to do is email us, panel@WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. So we look at this issue of deadly force. We look at this issue of what is happening in in Atlanta. And of course, Libby, I'm just interested in what you make of the overall duration, length, and the continued protests that are going on that seem to be an indicator that this issue is resonating and one of great concern, and giving us calls for racial and social justice.
I just want to go back to one thing. That, you know, we were talking before about the use of force and the perspective, the bias that's already there that these people are going to hurt me from the police perspective just because they're black. So you take that perspective and couple it with the anger that many of these policemen probably have in Atlanta because some of their colleagues have been fired. That, I think, is a deadly combination, and people will have a hair trigger, as it were. In terms of how long all of this is going to go on, I think it's going to go on for a while. I thought, you know, things would sort of calm down, and they did. I mean, we had a peaceful protest in Cohoes, of all places, where you had the mayor, Bill Keeler, and John McDonald, the assemblyman, both taking a knee at various times during the march. I think that these kinds of I think what's going to happen here is that this is going to become more organized, more institutionalized in terms of, like the gay rights movement and Pride, we're seeing long-term people standing up, not willing to be shut up. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. I think that we're going to be involved with this, dealing with this, educating people around these issues for a long time. I mean, last night, 60 Minutes had a a great piece on what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 20s. I think the name of the town was Greenfield or Greenwood. And the massacre that happened there, there are other things that are coming out. We cannot deny our past. We can't deny that slavery built this country and that the anger around that is more than palpable. It's what's in our streets. And the response to that by police, by people in power, the militarization of the police, the continued subjugation of people of color and anyone who's not white or male for that matter, you know, it's going to be with us for a while. And it's a good thing that it is because it's a reckoning. We have to deal with this as a country. And we have the racist in chief in the White House who's just fomenting all of this. And that needs to change as well.
Jennifer, what do you think?
I'm done now.
That's all right. We weren't waiting for you to finish.
Okay. You know, I absolutely agree with Libby. I think it's going to go on for some time. I think that, you know, it's going to continue, and I think it's going to take different forms. You have some major figures, really, and figures that the younger generation follow a lot, like LeBron James, many of these athletes, who are really focusing in on showing you know, the systematic racism in voting process, which we know is a problem, and really trying to organize around getting the young people in particular to vote and all people to vote, but the young people too. And so I think that the awareness is out there for the physical protest continues, but also these other actions that help sustain a protest beyond the streets, like voting.
And could I just jump in,
please,
too? And the voting is, I think it's so essential. And, you know, to move from, it's always a difficult transition to move from the streets and protest to the less sexy details of elections and policies and platforms and all of those things. But I think it's so essential, and to kind of keep the momentum going in that direction as you get into the details, which are so crucial. But also, after people are elected, from whatever side of the aisle they're on, continuing to hold them accountable for results, not just allowing them to speak in sound bites, no matter who they are, not just allowing them to send out nice newsletters and show up at town halls and blah, 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 really demanding results and keeping the pressure on. And if they don't deliver results, voting them out and bringing in somebody new.
And that is what we're going to see, right? I mean, I am wondering, when you say voting them out, I am wondering how you think, all of you, think this is going to impact not only the presidential election, but impact House races, Senate races, and even local races, I mean, especially local races throughout the country. Libby?
Look, I think an interesting race that's going on is in part of Westchester County in the Bronx. You see Elliot Engel,
yes,
being primaried. His opponent has been endorsed by AOC. You know, in Massachusetts, we have a very interesting U.S. Senate primary going on. You know, these kinds of questions should be asked of these candidates over and over and over again, and they should be held accountable for giving serious answers, and then whoever wins it, giving serious results.
Jennifer?
I 100% agree. You know, I think that's really the next step. You know, the next two steps, really, voting them in, following up on them, making sure that they're accountable, and then if not, voting them out. And, you know, giving time, too, to other people who are not necessarily from the political background, but want to be involved. I think we're going to see some new figures start to surface around the country to get involved in local and state politics.
Yes.
And Libby is our political consultant.
You know, I think we can look at the race to replace Nita Lowey down in Westchester. It's like a 6 or 7 way Democratic primary. Some people who are sitting assemblymen or state senators, other folks who come out of the Obama administration. And there's one man of color, Mondaire Jones, who got the New York Times endorsement this weekend. And so it'll be interesting to see how, you know, a mostly majority white affluent district votes their conscience in terms of, is it time for us to be represented by a man of color who's on the left? You know, he's primarying from the left. And that will be an interesting race to watch. There are other primaries across the state, you know, in the assembly, where and some in the Senate, where Democrats are being primaried from the left. And, you know, we see in the state Senate, you know, they got all the social progressive stuff done at the beginning of their last year, you know, and things sort of broke down this year because of COVID-19. But I think you're going to still see people pushing from the left against the Democratic establishment. The question remains this, you know, everybody's talking about, okay, they do their sound bites, they do their rhetoric, they get elected. Now they have to deliver results. The question remains that all the folks historically who have been elected as reformers end up being the people they wanted to replace because they now have the power. And it's really about whether or not we're going to have a new generation of elected officials that aren't beholden to the power and their need to get reelected, but actually serve the people.
Go ahead, Alan.
You know, Joe, I'm interested in the fact that New York, in terms of what Libby is saying, New York State has both houses are led by persons of color. And that is extraordinary. I mean, I think New York is way ahead of the rest of the nation when it comes to recognizing what some of this stuff is all about.
We have some letters on this. Go through them. Just a few before we take a break in a moment. That is from this one from Wayne, who says the Supreme Court's Graham versus Connor says that reasonable force is judged through the eyes of the officer at the time of the incident. Nothing should be considered prior or with 20/20 hindsight. This is the reason jurors cannot convict. We got this from another listener who says, unless I missed it, no one has yet to mention the obvious. There was no reason to shoot Rayshard Brooks in the back. I think we did mention that, but I don't know if they mentioned at all. I don't know. But his car remained on the scene with all his pertinent information, driver's license, registration, et cetera. They could have easily tracked him down. I think, Libby, that was your point, right?
Mm-hmm. And Jennifer.
Said
that too.
Let's see. We go to Diane, who says, my question is, why did they need to shoot the fellow? They have his car. How far is he going to run without his car? Why couldn't the police simply use the license plate number to track him down later? Bernard writes, agree. You've seen the offender, has the car and plate. Person can be arrested later. The officers only shoot blacks to kill, even when the officer is aimless. Officers don't shoot or hit whites even when offenders are resisting and striking officers. Just complete hate of blacks by most whites, and they become police officers. They get the license to kill. We also have this one that says a big piece of the work. This is from Vincent. A big piece of the work in reforming law enforcement agencies is to recruit champions and leaders with those organizations to emphasize how bad actors are as detrimental to their own organizations and colleagues as they are to the communities that they serve. The smart people that I know in law enforcement want to change, but not wholesale criticism that paints all with the same brush. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We return. I saved this particular letter for after the break, hoping it would lead us into some more detailed conversation. Mary writes, please discuss All Lives Matter. At a Black Lives Matter demonstration last week, a white woman driving by angrily screamed, All Lives Matter. Sure, all lives matter ideally, but that's not our present reality. Can the panel please explain why we're focused on Black Lives Matter and why saying All Lives Matter misses the point? Jennifer, would you like to begin with that one?
Sure. Because Black Lives Matter is not saying that all lives don't matter. What it's saying is that all lives do matter, but that a portion of the population, who are people of color, have disproportionately been affected in a way where their lives or their lifespan has been interrupted by police violence or police brutality, and then also by the behavior of other citizens in America who act knee-jerk, careless, or purposeful, and do it overly to people of color. Mm-hmm. That would bring up a case like Ahmaud Arbery, right? And then we see the delay in the prosecution, the steps to arrest, the steps to investigate, and those sort of things. So that kind of brings up the two different points. It's not just a police brutality, and it's not a, we're ignoring, people are ignoring all lives. What they're saying is they all do, but not everybody is paying attention to this population like they should.
Can I just say that what Jennifer just said should be recorded and just played for anybody who says this over and over and over again, you know, that comes up with the same kind of tired question over and over again. I mean, not that your question was tired, of course, Joe, but the explanation.
And I think the letter writer was writing from a good place of just saying, you know, why are we having that particular discussion? Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just speaking more about the person who yelled it out of the car. They need to hear the recording of that explanation.
Absolutely. Libby.
Well, I don't have to say anything more than what Jennifer said. I mean, it's really this notion of when people say all lives matter, I think that's a dog whistle for Black lives don't matter. You know, because if people really understood systemic racism and institutionalized racism and what people of color, brown and black people have gone through in this country, they would understand that the preponderance of people murdered by police are people of color. Mm. It's just that simple. Black men in specifically. And so we have to say these words despite how uncomfortable it is for some people. And for those people that say all lives matter, the issue for them is that black lives really don't matter to them. You know, and I know you're going to get letters now. I mean, that's going to just light up the board. But really, you know, we have to get outside of our whiteness and stop being so defensive and recognize that we are complicit in this as white people if we don't stand up and say something.
I just want to say you can. I just want to say that if you do want to write a letter, it's panel@wamc.org. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, and you know, this past weekend, we haven't brought this up yet, but the Black Lives Matter kind of expanded to have a Black Trans Lives Matter march,
yes,
right, where they were all dressed in white in Brooklyn, and it was very beautiful to watch and support. And, you know, the other thing to remember is the three founders of Black Lives Matter are queer women, queer black women, right? And so they're not saying just only look at us. They're saying look at this whole picture and look at this group because of how distinct the differences are. And you know, I think the other idea about it is paying attention to the lives that are disproportionately affected by police violence, but then also, you know, civil, we'll say, or civic, the other communities' violence towards people of color. We have to include in this conversation, you know, how Native Americans have been treated in this country, right? Because though that's a long conversation and people kind of now accept, right, the idea behind the genocide of Native Americans and culture, we forget that there was a protest about the pipeline, right, not too long ago, and there's still problems with that issue happening in Native American communities and others, other issues, right? So Black Lives Matter is really drawing on that kind of whole diversity of people, not simply just the black people, though those are the ones affected the most disproportionately.
You just, you know, go ahead,
you know,
on.
It's just fascinating to watch the crowds and watch as the cameras pan who's out there and see the number of white faces. Now, you know, this is not a black issue anymore. This is a national issue. And you're right, Jennifer. It is the looking into our entire American history. We've known for a long time that we've been disgraceful with the way we treated, Native American population in this country. And so it's as if a wave has just come over all of us in which people are saying, okay, we have to really engage in a tremendous reevaluation of everything that's going on.
You mentioned just a moment ago, Jennifer, and I think it is important to bring up that on Friday, the Trump administration finalized a regulation that overturns Obama-era protections for transgender people against sex discrimination in healthcare. The policy shift, long sought by the president's religious and socially conservative supporters, defines gender as a person's biological sex. The Obama regulation defined gender as a person's internal sense of being male, female, neither, or a combination. LGBTQ groups say explicit protections are needed for people seeking sex reassignment surgery treatment, and even for transgender people who need medical care for common conditions such as diabetes or heart problems. Libby, this is, I have to say I was really disturbed when I read this. I mean, not surprised, but it is just yet another, you know, you think for every step forward, you take many steps back.
Well, this is just a continuation of Mike Pence's influence on this administration. I don't think Trump really cares one way or the other. I think this is Mike Pence and the radical Christian right and their hatred of the LGBT community. And doing this, you know, denying basic health care to trans people is a death sentence. You know, there have been stories, I've read plenty of stories. There was a movie called Southern Comfort that came out a long time ago about a trans man who tried to get health care in the South and he was denied. Doctors wouldn't see him. It's just that simple. And it happens a lot. And, you know, this notion that we can allow health care professionals, whether they are doctors, nurses, pharmacists, to use their own personal biases and what they consider to be their religious beliefs to determine who they're going to serve is a total violation of the Hippocratic Oath and what it means to be a healthcare professional in this country and in the world. And it means that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, these people are morally bankrupt. There is no moral code. There's no moral reasoning around denying trans people healthcare other than they hate you. They hate us. They hate the LGBT community. And they would like to see us go off on an island someplace. I mean, I know I've said this before, but it's absolutely true. They don't want us here. They don't want to see pride flags. Up in Saratoga, in Milton, New York, which is Republican, the town supervisor, who is a Republican, has put up a pride flag three times, and each time it's been torn down. It's so clear to me that despite all the celebrations we may have, all the pride that we may have, the hatred towards LGBTQ people in this country is still palpable.
Let's pause there, and then when we come back, we'll continue. We'll have more on that, and we have many more letters that we'll get to as well. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post, we welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after a news break with Ray Graff and much more after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 15th of June. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post make up the group. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We have many letters from the conversation that took place in our last hour. I'm going to try to get to as many as we can before we move on to other topics. Frank says, Mr. Brooks spoke to the police for 45 minutes, mentioned his daughters, and offered to leave his car in the lot and walk home. Why didn't the cops drive him home and give him a DWI ticket at his house? This would have been a civilized end to this event. They didn't even have to handcuff him if he was locked in their police car. No common sense. Anna says, can policemen not run anymore? What happened to chasing on foot after a suspect? Keith says, I'm not a defund the police person, but defund the police. Enough is enough. We need a new way to police in America because our current system is murdering our citizens. America has lost confidence in its police forces. How can they protect and serve when we do not have confidence in the police because they lie, cover up, gas, harass, abuse, and murder the people that they are sworn to protect? Panel, jump in if you hear anything that you would like to comment on, please. Richard says Rayshard Brooks was running away from the police when he was shot in the back and killed. It is true that the police did not need to apprehend him due to the fact that they had his car and all of his info already, and they could have just arrested him later or the following day at home. But even if they did not have his car or any of his information, Rayshard Brooks was running away and posed no physical threat and therefore should not have been shot in any circumstance. Tony asks, I think, a really good question. Maybe we can spend a moment on this. How come there is not more emphasis on developing more and better non-lethal weapons? We don't typically kill wild animals who wander into civilized areas. We use tranquilizer darts. Can we encourage industry to develop such devices to give this need for police to instead lessening the need for police to shoot bullets?
I think that's a great letter, great question. And I've wondered that myself. I'm certainly no expert in policing, but it seems that we could put the best minds on these sorts of things and look at the case studies of this kind of incident and see how it went bad so quickly and say, okay, let's understand the different ways that this could have gone and how could we use technology, training, de-escalation methods, etc., to do it in a different way with a different and better outcome. It doesn't seem like that should be impossible to do. If you're willing to take on the initial resistance from the police force or the police unions, et cetera.
We got a lot of letters regarding Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter. Joseph says, great explanation by Jennifer. I've always taken the phrase as having an implied to or as well at the end. I think some white people imagine the implied word to be more very asleep. Terry writes, for the people that believe all lives matter, I would like to compare that to the human body. Let's say you go out and you break your arm. The doctor is not going to come in and say you broke your arm, so we put you in a complete body cast because all bones matter. You need to take care of what is broken or injured first. Then there is this interpretation. Janice, here's my thought. If you sit down at a dinner table and there are two starving people seated with you, you don't say, everyone's hungry. You serve those who have been denied. Then William says, regarding chance of all lives matter and claims that white privilege doesn't exist, I heard the following recently, which follows in Jennifer's point. White privilege doesn't mean your life hasn't been hard. It just means the color of your skin isn't one of the things that makes it harder. We go to Lorraine, who says, we said Black Lives Matter, never said only Black Lives Matter. We know all lives matter. We just need your help. And that is something that's been passed along on Facebook as well. And then we go to Claudia, who says, my daughter, a former juvenile criminal defense attorney, now health justice attorney, came up with the following description. Imagine you live in a block and someone's house down the street is on fire. The fire trucks rush by your house to get to you and put out the fire. You stand there watching and say, hey, what about my house? My house matters, but your house isn't on fire. You have to focus our attention on where the fire is. Anybody with any comments on any of those very good examples? Okay.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
Hearing none, we go on. Sherry says, after a peaceful protest in Cobleskill, a mentally disabled man came up to me and asked me what my sign meant. It said, support racial justice. I told him it meant that all people should be treated equally. He asked white people as well as black. I said, all people. He said, right on. I knew this was a form of All Lives Matter, yet I felt the need to reach him in a way that he would understand. Perhaps we need to meet people where they are and have the conversation. Again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's move on to...
Joe?
Yes.
Joe, something just broke. The Supreme Court ruled that existing federal law forbids job discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. It was a 6-3 decision. So nationally now, people can't be fired because of their sexual orientation, and there are more rulings to come out today. People are like texting me and Facebooking me. I'm like, this is unbelievable.
So the federal law protects LGBTQ workers, according to the Supreme Court.
Right. Yes, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
So
you know,
go ahead.
It worries me a little bit. I'll tell you why. There's a whole, as Libby just said, there's a whole bunch of very important decisions coming out, and I just hope that this is a sign that the court, which is certainly a conservative court, is not just giving one to one side and hoping that they can just sort of close down everything else as it all goes. And that's what I'm worried about. We'll see today.
This is just, I mean, I'm sitting here, folks, and the tears are coming because this has been a long time where I've been fired from jobs. There's been so many other people who have been fired or not given promotions or not even being hired because either they're out or they're perceived to be part of the community. So this is just a wonderful, wonderful thing to have happen.
Do we know where the 6-3
now,
was?
Now,
do we know where the 6-3 was?
I can't find that. Not yet.
There was just came out.
Is,
yeah.
It says Roberts and Gorsuch joined the liberal justices.
Roberts and Gorsuch.
Roberts and Gorsuch.
Yeah, right. I think Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion.
Wow.
Very
interesting. Now we can be hired and married in all 50 states. Wow.
Also, the Supreme Court on Monday declined to take up new cases for next term that gun rights groups claimed denied Second Amendment rights. The court did not accept a batch of nearly a dozen cases that gun groups had hoped the court, fortified with more conservative members, might consider. Among them were cases involving restrictions in Maryland and New Jersey to permits for carrying a handgun outside the home. So, another case that we'll be following. Yes, Alan.
You know, Joe, we take a look at what this court is doing, and we're wondering whether the judges are looking at what's going on in the streets. In other words, or what's been happening in this country, and saying, we better be careful here.
Well, and also, and you know, to that point, Alan, I'm wondering about, you know, we're expecting the DACA decision today or Thursday or over the next 2 weeks. And you do wonder about the release of that, of depending on what the decision is, of keeping in mind the protests and what this could mean for further agitation.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do then. And how you move on with that. Libby?
The other thing they seem to have done today is that they turned aside the Justice Department and won't hear this California Sanctuary Cities case.
Say that again, Libby. What'd they do?
They said no to the Justice Department and will not consider a challenge to the California Sanctuary Cities case. And that is a state law in question bars police from notifying the feds when immigrants are being released after serving time for local crimes.
Hmm.
You know, I think what you were saying before, Alan, and I think Joe was saying it, I think what's going on in the streets right now is having an impact on the Supreme Court. It's also Pride Month, so it's lovely to have these things happen during Pride Month. But, you know, I do think that the Supreme Court, I think John Roberts is looking at what's happening in this country and is saying, my court is not going to be complicit in this. And I think I'm just speechless.
Well, I hope
one can only imagine the tweets that are about to start emanating from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I know. Yeah. I know. And it's, yes. Yes. Wow.
It's a lot. Well, we're going to follow a lot of this, obviously, as these decisions come in and we find out more information. It's all just starting, and as far as the information coming out. So we'll try to bring you as much as we can as we go through this morning and comment on it. We should also note that as we go through this morning, that U.S. markets are dropping amid fears over rising virus cases. We saw that on Thursday. We saw a little bit of a rebound on Friday of about 500 points. And today, the Dow so far is down 600 points. The sell-off continues. Last week's sharp decline amid warnings that the recovery could take much longer than the White House officials had hoped. Which brings us to another story that we can talk about, because I do think it is, and one that we had on our, to use Supreme Court lingo, had on our docket, and that was the governor of New York State yesterday came out and said, look, we could be, with what we're going through right now, we could be ready for another lockdown. We're not far away from that. He said that the state has been deluged with complaints about businesses that are in violation of the reopening plan, a number that he said has alarmed and upset him. He said, we have never received more complaints in a shorter period of time. Mr. Cuomo said that bar patrons in Manhattan and the Hamptons on Long Island have been flouting the rules and warned that if local officials did not crack down on such behavior, the state could be forced to suspend reopening plans. In Houston, officials warned last week that a lockdown might be reimposed as cases continue to tick upward. CBS has reported that the region is now what officials call code orange, meaning that there is a significant and uncontrolled level of coronavirus spread in that community. But nationwide, we are seeing numbers increase, and increase to a great number, bringing with it great concern. Alan?
Well, you know, I'm just fascinated by Cuomo and his guts. I mean, he has a lot of guts. I was listening to NPR this morning. He called up some of the bar owners
right
in New York State, and he let them have it. And he said, I'm going to take your license away. Political figures can do what's politically right for them. But this guy is showing a lot of moxie when it comes to saying this, we're in a bad spot, and I know that in the end, I'm going to be judged by how we did here. That's where I am. I've just got great respect for him.
You know, I think that a lot of people, or a notable amount of people, seem to be engaged in magical thinking right now, that they have this idea that the virus has been beaten somehow, and we've won that, and now we can go, you know, hang out in ways that weren't allowed before, without realizing that, you know, nothing has really changed. The virus is still there, it's still incredibly contagious and dangerous. There's no vaccine. The testing is still all over the place. The only thing that kept the numbers down was a change in behavior. And it's really worrying and astounding to see people flouting this. It's beyond belief, really.
To say nothing of what's going on in China. They're having their own resurgence.
Right. Beijing locked down as the government rushed to contain a new outbreak. And it just seems to me that the federal response, at least from the White House, seems to just be ignore it, right?
It's bad for the election.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been all about. Is this, I don't care. I'm going to let tens of thousands of people into a public place and let them infect each other. And we know that it's going to, because we're making them sign that they're not going to sue us as a result of this. This guy doesn't give a whit about what's happening to the American people.
I'm sorry.
And it shows how stupid his followers are. I mean, really. You know, on one hand, they think COVID's a hoax, but on the other hand, well, the president wants me to sign this just in case I get sick. I mean, they're idiots. They're just...
It's
astounding.
So on the Trump rally, since we last spoke, the rally has been moved. It originally was set for Juneteenth. We are hearing reporting now from the Washington Post that someone had to explain to the president what Juneteenth was. So when that was explained of because apparently getting through as to why this was a big deal was difficult. So they moved it, and then they moved it from the 19th Friday to the 20th. So there you go. But it's still in Tulsa. Meanwhile, the coronavirus won't be loosening its grip on the United States anytime soon, leading infectious disease experts said on Sunday. They are also uncertain how the viral spread will be affected by the patchwork of states reopening businesses and by large events like protests and President Trump's upcoming campaign rallies. The virus is not going to rest until it infects about 60% to 70% of the population, according to Dr. Michael Osterholm, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Experts have estimated that without a vaccine, about 70% of the population will need to be infected and develop immunity in order to stop the virus's spread.
I read that story, and it was the scariest thing I've seen in a long time. I mean, it means almost everybody's going to get it.
70% is certainly a large majority, isn't it?
What I found really scary about that is, right, that they're saying at this point in America, only about 1% of the American population has it, right? So when you look at that right there, that with what we have going on, it's only 1%.
Right.
And they're talking about 60 to 70%. That, for me, was more mind-blowing.
I think there were a couple of statements that were made over the weekend that I thought were interesting. One was, and who I actually attribute them to, I'm not sure. I will have to check. One was that there was a health official that said, the administration seems to be saying, oh, you know, we're worried about a second wave. We're not done with the first one. And there was another health official that said, if you look at this, and I think this may have been Fauci, but I'm not 100% sure, that if you look at this as a ball game, as a baseball game, we are only in the bottom of the second inning. Well, that is sobering. And that's for the first wave. That's not even looking at what we're going to see perhaps in the fall and winter. And then on top of that, you see the modeling that has come out showing an additional up to 100 to 150,000 deaths just from now until September, which...
That's a lot more, Joe, than the 15 cases that the president predicted we would have in this country.
At the very beginning, yes, absolutely. So it is, that is, you know, one of those things that as we look, I'm interested, Alan, in you're talking about the governor's guts. The governor, though, also is getting criticized as well for maybe even, of all things, moving too fast. That as these numbers are going nationally, in New York, we have taken a great toll, and no one knows that more than the governor. But are we moving too fast? We hear this in regards to schools. We hear this in regards to summer camps. We hear this in regards, well, in summer camps, you know, it's one or the other. It's either you've gone too far or you haven't gone far enough.
Let's put it this way. I wouldn't want to be governor. I mean, think about this for a second. We are facing this incredible pandemic on the one hand. On the other, our businesses, our economy has gone south significantly. That's the gentlest way I can put it. And he's going to be held responsible for either controlling the pandemic or not controlling it, or for letting New York fall behind other states and other places in terms of the economic consequences.
Just because I'm interested, let me poll the panel and ask, do you think the president will have his rally in Tulsa on Saturday?
I think he's going to push to do it for sure. I would be surprised if he canceled it. I was listening to his senior campaign advisor, Mercedes Schlapp, Mm-hmm. And she was just saying at the grassroots level, the people want to see him, his supporters. They are ready to see him. They have a strong base that will be, you know, it appeared that they would sort of be up in arms if he didn't come. So unless if he begins to really listen to some doctors and medical professionals, I think he's going to.
Oh, surely you jest.
Well, but, no. But he wants desperately. He wants desperately to win re-election. He knows if he goes the way he's going, he can't win re-election. He goes back to his political success, and he thinks it has to do with the fact that he's had these rallies. Therefore, ipso facto, he'll have the rally.
Right.
And we can see, you know, he's willing to, certainly willing to fly in the face of reason and good sense about these things. He brought the cadets back to West Point this weekend.
On Saturday.
To have an in-person graduation. And though there have been several cases reported among this cadet class, and it didn't, you know, nobody else is holding in-person graduations because it was, you know, an interesting political prop to be able to do this. And it's so I think.
So why did he do it?
Because it's great, a great photo op, and it looks good to be, you know, standing there in front of the Corps of Cadets, and all those photos of, may not have worked out so well for him though, because
all we're talking about is him coming down the ramp and not being able to take a glass of water.
It's
exactly,
so true.
Otherwise known as Watergate.
So Watergate, right?
Yeah, but he was also sort of incoherent. You know, I mean, it was clear that he was reading and that he just wasn't there. I mean, there really seemed to be no there other than self-aggrandizement, which is his stock and trade.
And by the way, over the weekend, he apparently said that he was not going to steal the election, as Biden said he would, and that he would do other things if he lost. But since he's the world's greatest liar, why would anybody believe him about anything?
Well, somebody an old high school friend just said to me on Facebook, so now Trump can take credit or will take credit for being the best friend of the LGBT community and communities of color.
Because of his Supreme
Court. And, you know,
Court.
He just might try to take credit for this.
Well, what about the try? Will he get any credit? In other words, forget about trying to get credit. You're right about that. But is there anybody who will be naive enough to say, okay, you are our champion?
No, yes, Peter Thiel and the Log Cabin Republicans. However, his base is going to go nuts against this. And so if he tries to take credit for it, he'll be alienating his base, the Christian right and all the MAGA people who hate us. I mean, there was a demonstration I just read about that happened in Florida, I think something called Miami something or other, and it took place where Black Lives Matter's demonstration took place, and it was all pro-Trump MAGA people, and they went after the gays, and they went after the Black Lives Matter's people. I mean, you know, verbally. And it was just, so it'll be an interesting balancing act, that's for sure.
Jennifer, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I have two separate points. The first one is really about the rally with Trump, because, you know, we're spending a lot of time talking about what's going to go on inside.
Right.
Where he holds this rally and this spread. But I'm also concerned about the protests that are going to go on outside.
The counter protests.
Right. And what elements are going to run into each other outside the protest when it comes to, you know, how we've seen protesters be treated. And also the anti-protesters, will say, who show up on the scene as well, who are not going to be able to get into the rally, but want to be there. So that outside space. And that kind of contest there is one of the things I'm concerned about. The other point, when it comes to, you know, will the president take credit for this major victory, long time coming, for LGBTQ rights, is I'm thinking about how this connects to healthcare, because you just have this other law, right, that is stripping people of access and proper treatment in the healthcare system. So now if people have jobs, and these jobs include, right, healthcare packages, but then they can't go and get services they need. We're sort of back we're at another troublesome point.
We have 20 seconds, but go ahead.
Okay, what Trump overturned was a regulation. And so this decision may very well trump Trump's regulation.
Trumping Trump. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, yeah, we will continue. We have much more to discuss. We will go on with our panel. We welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We did have breaking news in the last half hour. I just want to clarify a little bit because it was coming in piecemeal, and I just want to kind of bring it all together now. The Supreme Court has issued its most sweeping decision ever to protect LGBTQ people from discrimination, finding that a federal ban on sex discrimination in workplaces also protects employees on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. Despite same-sex couples winning the right to marry in 2015, firing workers for being LGBTQ has remained legal across much of the United States. Since federal law does not specifically name sexual orientation or gender identity as protected classes, unlike race or national origin. In a 6-3 decision, the court held that a federal law prohibiting workplace discrimination based on sex, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, applied to cases involving LGBTQ workers. From Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote in the majority opinion, "Today we must decide whether an employer can fire someone simply for being homosexual or transgender. The answer is clear. An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. Sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids." Monday's decision effectively changes that in a ruling that will bring a ripple effect across the nation, particularly by banning workplace bias in dozens of the country's Republican-controlled states, which never enacted state laws banning anti-LGBTQ discrimination. Libby.
I'm still sort of speechless. I mean, you know, what I said before was we could get married in all 50 states based on the last big decision that this court made, right? But then if you got married in Oklahoma and your employer found out about it, he could fire you the next day. Now that's not going that now that's illegal. Whether that's not going to happen is a different story, because I'm sure people will find another reason ostensibly to fire somebody. But this is a great victory. It makes the LGBT community, you know, first class citizens in this country in a way that we haven't had that status ever. And now that we have job discrimination protection and marriage together, that's what typical white people have. You know, there's still a long way to go for people of color, LGBT people of color. There's all kinds of nuances here that we still need to look at and be cognizant of and recognize that there are still struggles to be had. But this is just a great day for us. I mean, really, it's just incredible.
Hey, Joe, if I may, I want to read a letter. Yep. Usually that's up to you, but from Deborah, I love you guys. Thank you so much for all you do. I love all of the new panelists who bring a Black Lives Matter perspective and much needed intelligent discussion on policing and dismantling systematic racism. And then says Abby, but she means Libby, I love the emotion and tears in your voice as you announce the Supreme Court decision. It is a victory for humanity. I pray there will be more. Isn't that nice?
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
We also have kudos from Karen, who says, thank you for airing all of Governor Cuomo's address. That's why WAMC is so important and we need to support it. None of the networks are covering his addresses anymore. Like people who think the virus is over, they seem to think likewise. They seem to be unaware that many of us do not have good enough internet to watch online again. Thank you.
Let's remember how that happened, Joe. First, they were playing every bit of what the president was saying.
Right.
And so clearly CNN and maybe MSNBC decided, well, we have to have something that, you know, is equals it all. And they put the governor on. Then as the president faded from the scene and his group faded from the scene, now Cuomo is at risk of not being played there where he ought to be.
Right. And again, to the point of the letter of being
we're
that.
Doing it.
We're doing it, which gives me an opportunity to say that the governor is scheduled to be speaking at 11:30 this morning. And of course, we will be running that. But also to the point of what we were talking about earlier, that as the governor says, I mean, we still have many, many cases. And Dr. Fauci saying over the weekend that you know what we know as normal, a real sense of normalcy may not return until 2021, which I think many of us are it's starting to dawn on people. Not everyone, of course, but many. We go to Bobby, a couple letters in our final moments together. Bobby says, great news from the Supreme Court indeed. Regarding possible closings by Cuomo, I think the governor's main goal is not to be responsible for any more deaths, period. I really believe it weighs on him. He may or may not have moved as quickly as he could have, but he sure doesn't want to create a mountain for New Yorkers to start another uphill climb. Whatever he can control, and we all know about him and control, he'll do. And that makes me feel good. Let's see. We go.
Let me read an announcement from our wonderful Michael Bowen, who says we're currently on low power and backup antenna for tower climbers. I will update when they're done. That's from our wonderful Michael. And of course, we wouldn't want our tower climbers not to be able to have children ever again. So we're delighted that we lowered it.
Well, that certainly painted a picture, didn't it?
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're not hearing us, you know why. And if you're not hearing us, you can't hear us tell you why. But still, we get this letter from Tom, who says we have non-lethal methods to subdue suspects, but they are not the first choice. It is the personalities of some of the police. Police recruit the wrong personality types. Too many police are on ego trips. Too many play John Wayne at the first opportunity. I do want to go to our final story this morning, and that is the search for a vice presidential candidate by the Joe Biden team. The running mate search zeroes in on a group that includes at least four black women. The search has advanced to the next phase as his campaign conducts more extensive reviews of some prospects. That according to people with knowledge of the situation. Among the candidates who have progressed to the point of more comprehensive vetting or have the potential to do so are Senator Kamala Harris, Representative Val Demings of Florida, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, all of whom are black. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is white, is also in that group, as is New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, who is Latina. Jennifer, what do you make of this winnowing down?
You know, I'm still not quite sure. You know, what's bothering me a lot about this, and I think it's very obvious to many people, is that this is a scamper move, and it's very political in the sense that I think Biden's team is looking for someone that will help kind of sway some. They seem non-threatening to convert or sway some Republican votes his way. So I don't see Susan Rice being a person that ends up being taken on here, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of history there. I think this is becoming, you know, just so politicized, and I think some people are seeing through it. I hope some people are seeing through it. It's not that he shouldn't have a woman. It's not that he shouldn't have someone of color or a minority or, you know, even Senator Tammy Baldwin, I think would be, you know, somebody that he should look into a little bit more. But I'm afraid that this is a little knee jerk and not really from a wholehearted good perspective.
Well, in the past, the presidents have looked to vice presidents to help them get elected. Certainly, as I've said many times, JFK did with Lyndon Johnson, and those two men clearly despised each other. But without Johnson, JFK never would have been president. So I think, you know, you're right, Jennifer, but in the end, you have to do some politics. I think, by the way, that it's incredibly important it be somebody of color, and that the black vote is encouraged because, you know, they believe that he means business. So, you know, that's enough.
Well, I'm interested, Jennifer, in like what would ease some of your concern?
I think we just need to know more about all of these politicians. I think, you know, Senator Harris is a little problematic, only because, you know, and this is coming from the political analysis kind of perspective that Libby could speak much more on. But just because people, you know, have issues with her history and her involvement with criminal justice reform from the past. So we'll see if people are interested in what her ideas now are on that issue. I think Senator Bowers is very powerful. And some of what's happening in Atlanta right now, I think, may make her a very good candidate. But I guess I'm worried a little bit that this is a superficial pick, because we have to remember that Biden's team was largely mostly white up to this Black Lives Matter protest and the murder of George Floyd, right?
Yes.
And so I think he needs far more input from a diverse group on who to look at for the vice president position than what he's doing. I think he was behind the times a little bit in that before.
So are you predicting that it will be somebody, a woman of color or not, Jennifer?
I can't answer that. I'm going to say no right now. I'm not sure.
And I'm going to say
no more information.
And for what it's worth, I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think,
would also say yes. I think.
But that's
go ahead, Libby.
Well, no, but that's to Jennifer's point, right? That the decision making though would be more knee jerk than it is that the people in the upper echelons of the campaign, of that community not being diverse to make a non knee jerk pick, right?
Well, I'd like to know what I'd like to know
knee jerk.
Yeah, right. I'd like to know what the word knee jerk means. Here.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be knee jerk. They're going to be vetted. They're going to be vetted within an inch of their lives.
They want to win.
Right. And so I think it's either going to be Kamala Harris or Val Demings, who is from Florida, which will be a very important state. California is going to go for Biden. Florida is an important state. She's former law enforcement, so she's got that gravitas. She was great during the hearings during the impeachment hearings. She's well-spoken. I think that, you know,
she would be a
great pick.
And people know her. You know, I mean.
And people know her, and there's a narrative there. You know, there's a bootstrap narrative.
Jennifer, so, we have
a
minute.
I agree on Val Demings. She would be my first pick if I was choosing right now. Absolutely.
Jim?
I was just going to say that if he doesn't choose a woman of color, then that decision, I think, is going to take the wind out of the sails of his campaign. I think it will be. He'll have to answer that question for the rest of the campaign season, and it's going to really drag him down.
Especially now.
Right.
Well,
right. Absolutely.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Alan, thank you. Jennifer, Jim, Libby, thank you so much. We will continue. We have the Congressional Corner next with Sean Patrick Maloney. And then coming up at 11:30 will be Governor Andrew Cuomo. But first, this.